I was reminded of a verse written by Master Xuanhua the other day, which is a very useful principle to reflect on. So I thought I'd bring that up for some consideration this evening. So you see this in quite a number of his books or Dhamma talks. And the verse goes, "Truly recognize your own faults. Do not criticize the faults of others. Another's faults are just your own. Being one with everyone is called the great compassion." Truly recognize your own faults. Do not criticize the faults of others. Another's faults are just your own. Being one with everyone is called the great compassion. It's very natural for us in the human world to like some people and to dislike others. And particularly those who have hurt our feelings, people who have done things that upset us, who've done things that we feel are worthy of criticism, then the mind goes towards those people and say labels them as being bad or wrong or letting the side down or offending us or upsetting us. And when we don't understand the nature of perception and the forming of opinions, then we just believe those judgments to be true. And so we find that we can easily carry other people around. Maybe it's some, say, random contact that we have, somebody who that we're sharing the road with, somebody in the queue at the airport, somebody in the passing by in the corridor, or it can be someone that we have a long-standing relationship with, one of our siblings or a parent or a fellow member of the monastic community, or someone that we've worked with, someone that broke our hearts, someone that let us down, someone who damaged us in our childhood through one means or another. Yeah, betrayed us. I remember Lumpur Sumedho often talking about this childhood friend that who was his sort of dearest companion, who I think when he was about 8 or 9 years old, suddenly let him down and sort of dumped him and went with a different group of friends, and how distressing that was for the 8-year-old Lumpur Sumedho. So whether it's something very, old and deeply rooted, or whether it's something that is very recent or shallow or just a passing contact or anything in between, I feel it's very useful for us to look at that, finding fault and blaming and the attitude of mind that I'm unhappy because of you. If you were different, everything would be all right. And so my unhappiness is your fault, and that you shouldn't be that way. Just, if anyone thinks I'm reading your mind, don't be reassured. I'm not. This is just this is like breathing, and the force of gravity. This is just what we tend to do as human beings. We create the image of others in our minds, and then some we like, some we dislike. And then, without realizing that this is an opinion that's being formed, we then carry those people around. And when we do that, when we create a negative image of someone, we don't realize how much dukkha we're causing for ourselves, how much stress we are creating within our own heart, because it's just a normal, ordinary thing to do. Well, yeah, he did do me wrong, and so, yeah, I do. I do carry that around, and yes, it's not something that can be forgiven, so I'll just keep carrying it around. Thank you very much. when we can see how the mind does this, and then we also reflect on how much of a burden, a strain that creates upon us, then we also can begin to see how we don't have to do that, or that this is just a habit of our minds, a habit of creating an image of another person, and then taking that to be true and real. And that when we begin to see, well, this is just what the mind is making of it, then and also how much stress and tension that brings within us, then we are able to see how the mind is doing that, how the mind creates a memory, attaches a story to it, and also how that creates division between ourselves. Because even if we create a fixed image in the mind and we see that we have negativity, even if we are trying to be practicing Buddhists and we feel like, well, I shouldn't carry this negativity around, I should, instead of having all this hatred for that person or feeling of resentment and a desire for revenge or to punish them, you know, I shouldn't feel like that, I should have loving kindness. We're still, in a sense, carrying the other person around. We're having those negative feelings, but we're still, filling the mind with a sense of me here and them out there, and me trying to make it right with them. And so that even if we're trying very hard, like, I shouldn't be negative, I shouldn't have hatred, I should have loving kindness, then we are unconscious of the fact that we're creating a solid sense of me here and a solid sense of them out there. And so the habits of self-view, sakkaya-ditti, are being strengthened, they're being made more real, they're being given value. And so it can be very confusing or frustrating, because even if we're trying to get it right and repair the damage, the more that there's a me here and a them out there, and I'm trying to make it right with them, I've got a problem with you, and I'm trying to fix it so that you and me are all right. The very fact of creating a solid me here and a solid you there means that it can never quite work. At least from my experience, that's how it is. So the way that the practice of Dhamma can help us to resolve that is to bring attention to that self-creating habit, the other creating habit, and to see that the mind is creating this idea of there's a me here and a you there, and I want to make it all right, or that even if you haven't quite got that far, that there's a me here and a you there, and I want you to be punished, or I want you to suffer because of all the hurt you've done me. When we begin to look at the mind and to see the way that it takes hold of memories and stories, and we see the dynamic, you know, if I have had an argument with someone, and if I've argued with Ajahn Kongrit and I want to make everything all right, and I've already created a story in my mind, oh, I said this to Ajahn Kongrit and he was really upset, so next time I see him I should say this and I shouldn't say that, and I want him to feel this way and I don't want him to feel that way, the more that I'm full of my script, my prepared idea of what I should say, then when I meet Ajahn Kongrit, when we're in the room together, I don't see him, I just see my script. I've got my projection of ideas about him, so I don't actually meet him at all. I've just got my list of things to say. And even though my intention is to try and make it all right, we're not actually meeting, and he's probably doing the same thing as well. so even though we're in the same room together, then there's that, what you have instead of a real meeting, a real dialogue, you actually have like two monologues, you know, crossing each other. I'm talking at you and you're talking at me, and we don't really hear each other. We don't really meet. We don't really receive each other. So in terms recognizing of our own faults, don't criticize the faults of others. When we are seeing that quality of negativity, the things that we find upset us in other people, part of that, the process of not creating them, is to consider, well, why is that so upsetting? Yeah. And then in that, the thing that you see them doing that is so annoying, or why they hurt you. And in Master Hua's observation in that little verse, he says, yeah, another's faults are just your own. So this is a simple phrase or an observation, and maybe it doesn't apply to every single one of us in every single situation, but it's often the case. If you keep seeing how people are very aggressive and judgmental and neurotic, it can be because you are upset, you are aggressive and neurotic, and that you keep seeing that in the people around you. If you are judging other people as being filled with greed and self-centeredness, it could be because your own mind is prone towards greediness and self-centeredness. And so that one of the first stages is to look at when you see the judgments that you make about other people, to look at that and to ask yourself, well, I'm seeing that as a fault. I'm seeing this person as being very greedy or filled with selfishness. I'm seeing them as being really jealous. Is it because that's a habit that I have? You know, just to take that statement, another's faults are just your own. And to hold up a mirror to our own attitudes. Now, this is not to create a self-criticism, but just to be seeing, where do those habits come from? When I judge you as being jealous, or I judge you as being needy, or I judge you as being neurotic or fearful, where do those judgments come from? What are they based on? Am I subject to the same habit? So we're looking to see our own conditioning. What are the forces at work within our own mind? What motivates us? What's coloring our perceptions of the world? When we see the way we judge others, and we can look within ourselves. Again, this process is not to be feeding self-view, but just to see that nature works in different patterns. If it's the case that I've got habits of being very self-centered, egotistical, and I keep seeing that in other people, that he's really inflated, or she really thinks too much of herself, or that person's really proud, or really wants to be someone special. And then if I explore that and look at that and go, oh, that's really, I'm seeing that everywhere around me, because that's a powerful feeling within myself. I want to be the top dog. I want to be the special person. I want to be the one who's successful and praised. And look at that. So the idea is not then to create self-criticism or feed self-view, but just to recognize, well, that's the pattern of things. Just like a narcissus has a particular shape and a particular fragrance as a flower. A daffodil has a different shape, a different color. The hyacinths have yet another shape and different colors. The magnolia trees have different kinds of flowers, different shape, different forms. The oak trees, the beech trees, the silver birches, they all have their own shapes of branches and leaves. They have their own different kinds of flowers. The catkins on the hazel and the blossom on the cherry trees, they're all different. So you can see your own characteristic, whether you're a jealousy type or you're a fear type or you're an anger type or you're a confused type or you're a subject to what they call a multiple hindrance attacks. So you're both agitated, sleepy, aversive, greedy, and filled with doubt all at the same time. It's called a multiple hindrance attack in the trade. I don't think there's a Pali word for it. But then that's just like the different shape of a cherry blossom or a daffodil or a catkin. This is just the shape of the nature of our own personality, our own conditioning. It's not something to be embarrassed about or upset about, but just that's the shape of it. When we see that critical nature, is going back to that, and we see the painfulness of that, the stressfulness of that, then we consider it, we look and see where that comes from, then we can reflect. Well, this is the Buddha's encouragement, is to recognize that whatever mental formation, whatever kind of perception or judgment, whatever sanya, whatever perception, whatever sankhara, whatever mental formation, this is not me. Ne tang mama ne so hamasmi na me so me ata. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not my true self. This is not what I really am. It's just a pattern in nature. And so similarly, for that of others. And so we see that the mind out of habit is continually creating self and creating other. But we don't have to do that. We don't have to create each other as solid, permanent entities. And that when we see the habit of mind that says, oh, Ajahn Congwit is like this, Ajahn Anando is like that, then when we recognize, well, that's just my mind's perception or the story that I like to tell myself about what Ajahn Congwit is, but that can't possibly be the whole story. That's just one set of perceptions. That's all. We see that our perceptions are temporary. They arise and they pass away. They're subjective. It's from this particular point of view. You know, I'm sitting here up on the Dhamma seat looking out at the temple into the northeastern corner of the temple is right in front of me. If you're looking at me, you're looking at the southwestern corner of the temple. We literally have a different point of view. So when we are able to reflect, well, that's just my perception, and perceptions arise and pass away, how could this judgment be the whole story? How could it? Then we are able to to interrupt, to stop that habit of the mind of making solid and firm judgments. That when there's a feeling of disliking, you know, well, that's just a feeling that arises, or a judgment of this person is like this, that person is like that. That judgment is not something that's permanent and real and dependable. It's just a wave of feeling that arises and passes away. Just like I was saying this morning about food, if you're hungry, then the smell, the sight of food is interesting. The mind gravitates towards the food because we're hungry and it's time to eat, and the body says yes, because that's what our animal instincts trigger. If you're sick and you're feeling uncomfortable, nauseous, that you have a fever, then the same smell then becomes something that's repulsive, that the smell or the sight of food, as we say, it turns your stomach. Ooh, please. The same smell is off-putting. Or if you notice how when you come into the sala, before the mealtime, 11:30, the smell of the food on the server is interesting, is attractive. Ooh, food, right. Oh, yes, I remember. Mealtime. But then, three quarters of an hour later, when you've had your meal and people have left the sala, and maybe an hour later, the same smell of food in the sala, you think, oh, this place really stinks. Open up the windows, air the place out. Really stinks of food in here. It's the same smell, I would suggest. But one is interesting and attractive, and the other is off-putting, and we interpret it as, oh, stinky. Quick, open the windows, air the place out. So, is it a good smell or a bad smell? It's dependent. It's impermanent. It's not something that has any solidity, any real core. When we see how the mind believes those judgments, and we see the painfulness of maintaining those judgments, carrying people around. And some people have a whole like telephone book of a list, pages and pages of people who've done them wrong, and the mind is just continually goes towards complaint and criticism, and that's how they live in relationship to the world. Then that's a lot of work, and it can be very stressful. But when you see that, when you really look and see how much of a pain that is, then the heart is inclined towards not doing that, to not sustaining that. And we see that we don't have to live in that way. And so also we begin to see that my happiness doesn't depend on you or what you do. It's not a matter of whether you do something that I like or whether you do something that I don't like. Well, what we begin to recognize is that our happiness depends on ourselves. It's up to me whether I experience happiness in the present moment or not. And if my happiness is dependent on what others do, then that's very fragile and liable to be disturbed and upset. But if we recognize that our happiness, our real contentment, our sukha, is completely dependent on our attitude, then we find that whether someone is doing something that we like or something that we don't like, we still feel content. We can still feel quite at ease. We're developing that quality of independence, and this is an attribute that the Buddha highly praised as a kind of spiritual maturity. One is independent of others in the training. You don't need anybody's help. You don't need anyone's praise or support. That your own contentment, your own freedom, your own happiness is independent of circumstances. A lot of this depends on being able to watch the flow of thought, seeing those judgments. So when you notice that's attractive, I like that person, to then notice, well, this is just the mind feeling pleasantness at the presence of another. When you perceive, oh, that person's unpleasant, they're off-putting, they're upsetting, to know, oh, that's the feeling of dislike. The degree to which the mind can know that's a feeling, and that's the mind creating a judgment, creating a person, then it's exactly to that degree that the heart is freed. Similarly, judgments about ourselves, or I'm doing really well, oh, that's great, I'm really pleased with what I just did, or what I just what I've achieved. That's a pleasing judgment about this person, about ourselves. Or that I feel embarrassed and upset about something that I just did, or my failure, or me getting something wrong, or doing something badly. I feel bad about myself, I hate myself. In exactly the same way, to recognize, well, that's a judgment. It arises and passes away. That's all. So the degree to which that can be seen as passing perceptions, mental formations, is exactly the degree to which the heart is liberated. So in an easy or simple way of speaking about that is we're simply learning how not to create ourselves and not to create others, that we're not making the illusion, we're not feeding the illusion of a separate independent entity, but rather seeing there are these patterns of perception and feeling, judgment arising and passing away. That's all. Creating patterns that we call me, patterns that we call you, and the heart that knows that these are simply patterns of nature, like the shape of a narcissus or a hyacinth or a beech leaf or a silver birch leaf, a catkin, then that's the degree to which the heart is unlimited, unbounded, unfettered, unburdened. And when we are not creating self, not creating other, then we're not saying that we are automatically approve of everything that we perceive. We're not saying that every smell is delightful or every image is pleasant. But our happiness is not dependent on pleasantness or sweetness, whether there's bitterness or sweetness, whether there's pleasure or pain, agitation or stillness, the heart is fully at ease. So then, this is when Master Hua says, being one with everyone is called the great compassion. This is maybe in the southern Buddhist world, we don't really use that kind of language of being one with everyone. It's not a bad phrase, because that, in a way, being one with everyone is seeing that we're all made of the same stuff. We're all just what we call you, what we call me, what we call the world. It's all just sankharas arising and passing away, patterns of organic change, of the patterns of the natural world arising, passing away. We're all built of the same stuff. We're all waves of the same ocean. There's no fundamental and absolute difference between any of us in any way, really. So that being one with everyone is a sense of that which is fundamentally real in you, and that which is fundamentally real in me, it's the same reality. There's the same quality. The Dhamma that is the fabric of your nature, and the Dhamma that's the fabric of my nature. How could it be different Dhammas? How could it be a different natural order? It can't be. So we're not also just sort of carrying that around as an idea, like I'm one with you. I want to be one with you. I'm one with everything. It's not just an idea that you carry around. You write it on a little badge and put it on your yarm, or you stick a little magnet on your fridge that says, "You know, I am one with everyone." But it's more of a moment-to-moment practice of not creating self and not creating other. And when that we are able to recognize and know those habits and to go against them, then we experience what it's like. So that if you have had a difference of opinion, or there's been a clash between yourself and someone else, and you think, oh dear, what's it going to be like? I've got that difficult meeting, that person was so upset, and we're going to be we've got to have this meeting, and there's this whole list of issues that they're bringing up. Then the mind easily goes to say, oh, well, when she says this, and I've got to say that, and then her husband's coming along as well, and he's got all kinds of opinions too. And the mind starts to make a list of all the things that we have to be prepared for or worried about. And yet, the most helpful thing, if you're, say, meeting someone that you know it's going to be tender issues need to be talked about, is to resolve to not create yourself, not create them. And the more that we can go into a meeting, you know, there's a scheduled coming together of yourself and some others or another individual where there's been some friction, difficulty, to set that in place, to not create that person, to not create yourself. Then when you actually come into the room together, then you really meet. Because you're not meeting your projection about them. You're not meeting your list of things that you're worried that they're going to do or say, or you're not just seeing your script of all the things that you want to say, but there's actually a capacity to connect. You're not talking to your projection. And the more that you are able to really meet and to have no agenda, no preconceptions, no prefigured ideas, then that also helps the other person or people to similarly drop their expectations and projections and drop their script. And so then you can connect in a sincere and straightforward way. So that I would say is that the real experience of being one with everyone is that that quality of openness and freshness and ready to be surprised by how you handle the situation or being ready for whatever comes up, and then the mind is able to respond in a flexible and well attuned way, rather than just being filled with our expectations, our plans, or our anxieties. Now, in looking at this area, it's also maybe useful to consider, why do we create these images of each other and say, this person is like this and this person is like that, and make judgments about others, make judgments about ourselves. Where does that come from? Why do we do that? If it causes so much dukkha, why do we have that habit? Why do we create each other and carry each other around? The ones that we praise, the ones we criticize, the ones we love, the ones we hate, the ones we're afraid of. Why do we do that? Why do we create these images and try to make them solid and carry them around? Looking at this within myself and the habit of doing that, it seems to be a lot based upon fear, and in a way trying to even though we might say look upon it as something that's unwholesome or that we or burdensome or stressful. Often what feeds that is just wanting to have a strong sense of identity. Because if I hate you, then that gives a solid sense of me. There's a me here who's living in opposition to you, and that gives a stronger sense of me. And even if it's a state of tension or argument, at least it makes me feel alive. I often quote this comment that was made by the Russian foreign minister way back. It's getting more and more ancient history now, but way back in the late 80s, when Mr. Gorbachev was reshaping the Soviet Union and he launched his programs of Glasnost and Perestroika, the renewal program for the Soviet Union. And he wanted to end the arms race because it was had bankrupted his country. And the Americans were very suspicious about this. And there was this particular visit that Gorbachev and his foreign minister, Mr. Shevardnadze, made to the U.S. And there was this meeting where they were all sitting down in Washington, and the high ups were having this round table meeting, and Mr. Shevardnadze made this comment. He said, "We are going to do something terrible to you." And then apparently there was this pregnant pause, and the Americans, okay, now we're going to get it. This is they've got this whole new weapon system that we never even found out about, and they're going to. This is the big threat. And so he really let it kind of, he played it for a, for a while, just let the pregnant pause just sit there and looking around the table. And so then, and then he told the Americans what this terrible thing was that the Soviet Union was going to do. He said, "We are going to deprive you of an enemy." And he was right. It was a that was the worst thing they could do for America, is to sort of take away communism as an enemy, because then it gave America an identity crisis. And even though it's a sweeping statement, I would suggest that the words terrorist and Muslim have become substitute for communist as that which is threatening and other, and that we have to armor ourselves against so that we at least feel like we're somebody that is existing in relationship to that which is dangerous and out there, because it gives us a sense of being. And it's very much the case, better the devil you know than the devil you don't know, that even a sense of identity built around pain and fear and aversion is better on the worldly level than not having a defined sense of identity. So the mind keeps creating problems, anxieties, and enemies to be worried about, because it makes it feel like there's a me here, a real solid me who's really got something to worry about. No, it really is a problem. There really is a threat. No, we need to be worried. And then there's a, even though it's a state of conflict or tension, something in the heart goes, "Ah, I've got an excuse to be someone." So I often also mention that it's a very common experience whereby if you, say you've been engaged in some kind of job, you're tidying up your room or cleaning the house, or you've been doing the dishes or carrying out some particular kind of job, and you've been busy at it for a period of time. And then you finally get to the end of the job, you finish cleaning the house, you tidied your room, you've hoovered the carpet, you finished the washing up, and you plunk yourself down in a chair and you go, "Ah." So there's a few seconds of, "Thank goodness that's over." "Ah." And then maybe 4 or 5 seconds later you go, "Ah." And then there's this quietness. And then there's this discomfort, and the mind starts to look for something to be worried about. I'm sure I should be doing something. I'm sure there's something that I should be concerned about, or I should be engaged in. And there's a discomfort. There's an insecurity. There's a kind of vertigo, like, "Ugh." And then you remember, "Oh yes, I've got those 15 emails to write, or I've." I'm already late for that other appointment. And then we feel relieved at having found something to worry about. Have you ever noticed that? Again, I'm not reading anybody's mind. But you think, when you realize, "Oh, I've still got this to do, I've still got that to do," then even though it's in a way it's an obligation or a task, it's a thing to create stress about, there's a relief in the heart. "Oh, I've got an excuse to be." That I can, I've got a defined sense of being, because there's all that stuff I should be doing, or there's, "Oh yeah, there's that problem. Oh my goodness, there's that issue with my uncle. I've forgotten about that." And something is relieved to have an excuse to be worried, right? Maybe some of you are thinking, "What the heck's he talking about? I'm just glad to have nothing to do." But I would suggest that for most of us, that dynamic is what we find, is that we like a sense of defined being. An undefined being is threatening. So we keep recreating other people's faults, other people's problems with others, and worries and aversions, to protect ourselves, to give something to hide behind, so it feels like there's a me who's doing the hiding. If you follow what I'm saying, at least there's a me here who's existing in a state of tension with a that over there. And it's like the Russian foreign minister saying, you know, that's a horrible thing to do, is to deprive you of an enemy. Then it gives you an undefined sense of being, and then you have to find another thing to exist in relationship to. So in terms of Dhamma practice, then to sustain that quality of not creating self, not creating other, it doesn't mean that we're trying to turn into a zombie or that we don't have a personality or a list of things to do. far from it. But what it means is that we are training the heart to be at ease with an undefined being, with not being anything, with, in a sense, with realizing Nibbana. You know, Nibbana is the place of no thingness. When the Buddha used that image of the island, he said there is an island which you cannot go beyond. It is a place of non-possession, a place of no thingness. This is why I call it the end of suffering. I call it Nibbana. It's a place of no thingness, a place of non-possession. So to the habits of self-view and that kind of addiction of the heart to being something, that's very threatening. It's death, it's the end, it's a disaster. It's a terrible thing. It's the terrible thing. Don't take that away. But so it's threatening to the habits of self-view, of ego-centered thinking. But it's liberating and delightful to the heart. So in the development of insight into the Four Noble Truths, this is a very, very common theme of Lumpo Sumato's teachings, is to focus on dukkha nirodha. When dukkha ends, when we let go, when that sense of I is seen through, it falls away, and there is no thing here, no thing there, to allow the heart to fully awaken to that and to delight in it, to rejoice in that no thingness, rather than to fill it up with some project or some issue or some problem. But to train the heart to rejoice, to delight in that lack of definition, of non-possession, of no thingness. And that's a training. That takes an effort to encourage the heart to simply be open to that and to not follow the instinctual reactions, to run away from it, to fill it up and engage with something, just to feed the habitual compulsions for ego-centered activity, self-centered thinking and attitudes. The way that we live as samanas, we shave our heads. You know, this is what we do every 2 weeks. Today's the new moon day. We shave our heads. We all wear the same kind of clothing. The nuns all have their dark brown robes. The anagarikas have their white robes. The anagarikas, their white robes. The bhikkhus are biscuit brown robes. And the samaneras, we sort of unify our appearance. We take our hair off. We de-emphasize the shape of the body. So whether you happen to be larger or smaller, taller or shorter, fatter or thinner, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really make much difference. It's all kind of baggy, shapeless clothing. And whether your hair is sort of thick and lustrous, or whether it's ratty and straggly, shave it off anyway. It doesn't really make much difference. So these style of appearance that the Buddha established for his monastic community is helping to support that quality of of lack of definition, of not trying to be someone special or something special, and that even if you're a monk or a nun, you can witness those habits that you want to have a robe that's a little bit different, or have a few more patches than the other guys, you know, or have a robe that's kind of just got a different kind of loops and tags that are just a little bit special, something that's a bit unique. And it's natural enough, even the few possessions that you have, something that wants to be not quite the same as everyone else. But it's important to reflect how the what's being encouraged is an ease with not being special, not being anything unique, and that that quality of comfort, or being able to say rejoice in simplicity, in just sharing a quality of wakefulness, a quality of respect for the Dhamma, that when we say open the heart to that quality of unity or spaciousness, that quality of openness, then it again there's a frustration to the ego that says, but I do want to be different. I want to be noticed. I want to be someone. Like I that there is a recognition of that, and that needs to be known and understood. But when we let ourselves pass through that, or let that just wash through the system, then we are in that allowing that to just pass through and dissolve, and say encouraging the heart to fully appreciate that lack of definition, that no thingness, that non-possession, non-possessiveness, then there's a tremendous richness, a great fullness of being, what they call the quality of punna, or fullness, completeness, is what is realized. So in the development of the Four Noble Truths, and the Third Noble Truth, as Lumpo Sumedho would often encourage us to consider, that dukkha nirodha is to be realized. So when there is that moment of letting go of self, that quality of lack of definition, notice that. We need to train the heart to say, oh yeah, this is what is present when the self-centered thinking falls away, is this. This peacefulness, this quietness, this stillness, this undefined quality, this unconditioned, unborn, uncreated, there is this. And turning the heart towards that quality of unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, undefined, unpossessive, this no thingness, then when the heart opens to that, then what is realized? What is here in that moment of non-grasping? What's present? And that if there isn't that realizing, that effort to awaken to that, then all those unwords, unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, non-possession, non-being, nothing, it just seems like a lot of nothing. As it says in the song, I've got plenty of nothing, nothing's plenty for me. but that just feels like pointless life. That I mean, that's like a disaster. It's like, what's the value in that? It's just, it's like being broke or being homeless. Like, what's so good about that? But when the heart truly opens to that, and it's not just seen from a worldly perspective, then what is experienced as the heart opens and awakens to the unborn, the unoriginated, the unconditioned, when there is that realization of that quality of non-possession, of no thingness, there's a tremendous freedom, a tremendous richness, and an infinite delight, a complete delight, a joy. I was reminded of, in saying that, a Bhikkhu Bodhi came along to visit a Bhayagiri monastery a number of years ago, and he was giving us a Dhamma talk, and he comes from a Jewish family in Brooklyn, and having the son of the family going off to become a Buddhist monk was a real disaster in the eyes of the family. And he was recounting how his father was really having a go at him one day and said, you're nothing, you know, what do you do? You don't have any hair, you don't have any money, you don't have any possessions, you're nothing, you got nothing. And then Bhikkhu Bodhi, being a fairly sharp-witted character, said, Dad, I should tell you, in my trade, that's a big compliment. in my outfit, to say, you're nothing, you got nothing, you ain't nothing, it's like, oh, thank you, Dad. that's high praise. You know, I'm really pleased that you see that. I'm not sure whether his dad quite got the point, but it was a very pertinent response. So when we say, going back to Master Hua's verse, then I feel this is very useful to consider. Truly recognize your own faults. Do not criticize the faults of others. And others' faults are just your own. Being one with everyone is called the great compassion. So it recognizes we do have faults. We do things that are unskillful. We think and feel things that are unskillful. We have impulses that are angry, that are jealous, that are greedy, that are lustful, that are petty. Yes, that goes with the package. Yeah. We have bodies that don't work perfectly all the time. That's why there are hospitals and doctors. We have minds that produce unskillful thoughts and impulses. That's part of the package. Like there's a person who came to visit today and said how she she'd never had any contact with Buddhism before. She was out of an Asian family, but she'd just been diagnosed with cancer, and so she was just trying to deal with this, and she said, well, so what's your advice, or what's the Buddhist perspective on this? And so what I said to her was, well, you know, from the Buddhist perspective, it's important to recognize that getting ill is a result of having been born. It's not that there's some kind of karmic problem, or that you're being punished for something, or things are unfair. It's just that's the way nature works. I said, you know, if you consider those hospitals, they're not for other people. They're not just for them. They're for all of us. And she's kind of looked at me and said, that's just what my husband's been telling me too. And so she said that a few times. And I said, well, I promise you that I haven't been talking with your husband before we had this discussion. But it's important to recognize there are hospitals and doctors and nurses because bodies don't work 100% perfectly all of the time. They go wrong. Things don't work in a totally flawless way. That's the system. Our minds produce unskillful impulses. We have irritated feelings. We feel annoyed. We feel lustful. We feel jealous. We feel afraid. That's what minds produce. Feelings of attraction, feelings of aversion, they produce opinions, judgments, random memories and longings, feelings of nostalgia, feelings of excitement and anticipation, feelings of fear. That's what minds do. It's not justifying the unwholesome as being good and wonderful, but just here it is. This is part of the package, just like the body's imbalances and ailments. That's part of the package. You have a body in it, and there's hundreds of billions of chemical reactions going on every minute. You can't control it all. You're not in charge. It's a natural system. So we recognize our own faults. Yeah, here are some impulses that are unskillful, and they're part of the whole system. Truly recognize your own faults. Don't criticize the faults of others. So just as my mind produces feelings of fear or anger or jealousy or lust or criticism, worry, so other people's do. So as well, why should they not? How could they not? And seeing that, you know, all of our minds basically work in the same way, all waves on the ocean all wave in roughly similar ways. They're all subject to the same laws. They're all made of the same stuff. That's how nature works. We're all part of the same natural order. And in recognizing that, then we're able to see it clearly, and we are able to then find that that sense of accommodating. We're able to not make anything out of our own faults, and or not to make anything out of others. We let those faults cease. So we're not justifying them or saying they don't matter, but just that's just a jealous impulse. That's just a fearful impulse. That's a greedy impulse. That's all. Whether we see it here or we see it there, they're recognizing, well, that's just a pattern of nature. And then as it ceases, then leaving that space open, not filling it up with a fresh judgment or some compulsion to do something with it or hang on to it or write a poem about it or apologize for it, but just letting it cease and allowing the space of our heart to be open. And then that is the great compassion, the great kindness, and the great gift that we can offer to others, is to not create them, to leave the space open, and to not create ourselves. So that that compassion or that empathy is a sense of leaving the space open to be who you are, and to let others be who they are, not wanting or pressurizing others to be different than the way they are. And another story that Lumpur Sumedho is often told is, and he was having particular difficulties with a certain monk way back when. He was abbot of Wat Pananachart, I don't know, 150 years ago, what was it? 40 years ago, in the early days of Nanachart, and he was having a lot of struggle with this particular monk, who was, I think, the second or third monk there. And he was also studying a bit about astrology in those days, and Lumpur Sumedho, as you might know, is a Leo. He's a sort of Leo plus plus. And this other monk who he was having struggles with was a Cancer. And Lumpur Sumedho also has a mind that is prone, is inclines towards creating images. It has he has a very strong capacity to visualize, and the mind creates nimittas or visual images very easily. And then during this period in his meditation one day, this very clear image of this large lion looming over this crab, saying, "Why aren't you a lion?" And the crab can, "Because I'm a crab." You know? And then this feeling of, yeah, that's really stupid. the lion is upset because the crab is a crab rather than being a lion. But, oh, so that was a helpful insight. When we just allow ourselves to be the way we are and allow others to be the way they are, then we are doing the greatest kindness. That's the greatest compassion that we can manifest. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.